Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for New Year's Weekend 2011. Perhaps this year you resolve to volunteer more of your time, but how?
95% of nonprofits say that they need and want access to skilled volunteers, but they don't know where to go to find them.
We will meet a volunteer matchmaker. And how about a safer, cheaper alternative to payday lending?
We wanted the same day cash. We wanted the quick, easy turnaround, but we wanted something that was affordable, something that was safe.
That story and more coming up. But first, Happy New Year, everyone. May your piggy banks overflow, your savings interest rates rise, and may all your debt magically disappear. If only. But what really will happen? We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to survey the land, or at least Marketplace Moneyland, to find out what 2011 might look like if all the stars line up, if we get really, really lucky, if pigs fly, which you never know.
What is the beginning of a new year for but to dream about things to come, or things you wish would come? With that in mind, I set out, magic wand in hand, to find out what some Marketplace regulars would like to see in 2011.
My name is Gail Cunningham for the National Foundation for Credit Counseling.
Cunningham helps people work their way out of debt.
I do need to wave that wand, and it would be over the job market, because consumers cannot begin to have financial stability until they have a steady paycheck coming in, and they can't make that mortgage payment without that paycheck coming in.
Former U.S. Labor Secretary and Berkeley professor Robert Reich also dreams of more jobs.
Well, my hope is the economy creates millions of jobs. In fact, so many new jobs that unemployment falls to 5%. The median wage rises 10%. Housing prices start moving up again. The overall recovery is buoyant.
Felix Salmon blogs for Reuters. His New Year's dream could pay for Reich's buoyant expansion. Well, maybe. It's kind of technical.
I would conjure up an abolition of the tax deductibility of interest for corporates, which sounds incredibly wonky and marginal, but you raise hundreds of billions of dollars, which we desperately need in order to balance the budget. Companies have this huge incentive to pay very little in dividends and to load up on very expensive debt, and it makes the entire economy very fragile.
Salmon's greedy. At least on behalf of the U.S. Treasury, he'd also like to see the tax deduction on mortgage interest sent to the dustbin, then add taxes on carbon and financial deals. Bah humbug?
I love getting lumps of coal in the mail. It makes me happy.
And then there's the dream that we'll all change our wicked spending ways, even after the recession's long gone.
I'm Knight Kiplinger, editor-in-chief of Kiplinger's Personal Finance magazine. My prediction is that Americans will start seriously saving more of what they earn. This is not good news for American retailers. They want us to go out and patriotically overspend, as was our habit back in the bad old days.
New York Times columnist Ron Lieber would wave a wand at the skyrocketing cost of sending a kid to college.
What the wand does is that it forces the schools, say NYU, for instance, to say, you know what? After $50,000 or $60,000 in debt, you're going to go have to take a year off to work because we do not think it is responsible to push you out into the world with six figures of debt at the age of 22.
Marketplace healthcare reporter Gregory Warner is conjuring a market-based solution to America's soaring health debt.
So imagine the sciatica fund. This is a wonderful vehicle essentially buying a slice of all the debt Americans will incur dealing with back pain. Very sizable pool. Or arthritis arbitrage bonds. AAA rated since no one's inventing a cure for that one.
Stacey Vanek-Smith covers media for Marketplace. She is dreaming of a whole new reality on TV.
It would profile a normal, functional family. There would be no weird hot tub, Springer-style attacks. The ratings would be huge because everyone would be so excited and fascinated to watch, like, family game night and their kids' school play, and everybody goes to their jobs and tries to support each other.
Steve Henn at Marketplace's technology desk has been looking around his office at all the screens and apps and gadgets that have taken over his life. He's waving his wand, well, everywhere.
Everything in my wallet sucked into my smartphone, and for that smartphone to get really, really smart, pay all my bills on time for me, let me know if I was spending too much money, and make sure I didn't bounce checks.
So you want sort of artificial intelligence that is actually a person with intelligence.
I think I want the old-fashioned phone back. I want Mabel.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
A new consumer has supposedly emerged in the wake of the Great Recession, one who's more price-conscious and selective about purchases. John Gersma calls this post-crisis shopper a spend shifter, and businesses are taking notice. Whether this new consumer is in it for the long haul is open to question, but Gersma profiles them in his book, Spend Shift. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tess.
We've been hearing about this shift in consumer behavior for the last couple of years, really since the economic collapse. What do your findings tell us that perhaps we haven't heard?
One of the more interesting things that we began to tease out during the crisis was that there was this sort of societal value shifts that we could see through spending, where people were actually more akin to wanting to support companies whose values match their own.
And what are those values?
Things like self-reliance, community, thrift, hard work, and stewardship. And those are the things that consumers were looking for. They were actually realizing that even though they find themselves less rich today, that they actually have their pocketbooks as a form of power and influence over corporations to sort of redress some of their wrongdoings of the past and serve their marketplace.
And it seems like that has kind of become, how do you put it, I guess, de rigueur, that this new anti-consumerism is almost an activism.
It's a little bit of déclassé consumption, I guess you could say. But really, the fact that 55% of Americans are part of this movement, it's very inclusive. You're just as likely to be a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent, or make above or below $75,000. But the important thing here is I think that people are now feeling culturally it's permissible to be thrifty. It's permissible to be sort of a smart shopper, whereas before you might have been seen as cheap.
So how are businesses responding to this? You went to cities across the country to kind of find out what the response was. Tell us a little bit about what you found.
One of the more exciting things was that despite the downturn, there's this tremendous sense of optimism and entrepreneurialism in many small markets around the country. We visited red states and blue states, and we went to places like Detroit, you know, where the average price of a home is $18,000. And yet we found some really interesting entrepreneurs that were rebuilding their neighborhoods. We met with one of 50 urban farmers, Patrick Crouch, who runs Earthworks Urban Farm, and he's helping to provide food for these emerging restaurateurs.
And I have to say, one of my favorite examples that you cite of this whole spend shift is the emergence of the taco trucks here in L.A.
Oh, Koji.
Yeah, exactly.
We spent an afternoon chasing around a Koji truck and trying not to get in a traffic accident.
So tell us how that fits in with the pattern that you discerned.
What's happening is you're seeing the power of social media to take these old core American virtues and actually amplify them and make them really resonant in culture today.
How much of this spend shift do you think would have happened regardless of the economic collapse?
I think it's an interesting question. What the crisis actually did is it sort of amplified what were building concerns over many years, the disparity of wealth in our country, the long-term desire for neighborhoods to sort of rebuild themselves. And what we started to see was that this recession cut across demographics and it cut across different parts of the country, the point where people really felt like they needed to make a profound change.
We've been using the term consumers a lot in this conversation, but you argue in the book that there are no longer consumers, there are just customers. What's the difference?
The word consumer, we're going to look back in a year or two, hopefully as sort of a term of ignorance and disrespect. It's almost implying a mindless, gobbling beast of indifference that's simply going to ingest anything you put out there in the marketplace. And what we see are very, very savvy customers that have all these access to these social media tools and are able to sort of scale themselves. We spent time with Andrew Mason, the founder of Groupon, who's built, you know, a multi-million dollar business mm-hmm. on the fact that people are coming together to get lower prices. So the customer is definitely the king.
So I have to ask you, how did your own spending shift, if it did?
Well, the first thing I did is I was thinking about a car, but I've had a 10-year-old Volkswagen and I decided to stick with it. But the other things I've tried to do is pay down debts. I joined a time bank, which is you donate services into a community and in exchange you get back services. So I'm trying to be part of the spend shift.
John Gersma is a co-author of Spend Shift, How the Post-Crisis Values Revolution is Changing the Way We Buy, Sell, and Live. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tess.
From changing how you spend money to how you donate, nonprofits are increasingly using social media and technology to connect with donors and volunteers. But to persuade someone to give money or time to your charity or cause, you have to connect with something the potential donor likes or believes in. Commentator Jonah Lehrer says it's all about an emotional response in your brain.
The first thing to note about giving away money is that it feels really good. For instance, several brain scanning experiments demonstrate that donating to a worthy cause leads to activation in the dopamine reward pathway. It's the same part of the brain that's turned on when we have sex or eat a slice of chocolate cake. In fact, there's typically more reward-related activity when we donate money than when we receive an equivalent amount. Giving is literally better than getting, at least from the perspective of the brain. But this generosity comes with a catch. Yes, we have altruistic instincts. Still, these instincts come with some real blind spots. Consider the work of Paul Slovic, a psychologist at the University of Oregon. He told undergraduates about a starving child named Rokia. She lived in a crumbling refugee camp in Africa. His students acted with impressive generosity. They saw her emaciated body and haunting brown eyes, and they donated, on average, about $2.50 to save the children. However, when a second group of students were provided with a list of statistics about starvation in Africa, like the fact that more than 5 million children are malnourished, the average donation was 50% lower. At first glance, this makes no sense. We should give away more money when we are informed about the true scope of the problem, not less. Why do we do this? The depressing statistics leave us cold, even when they are truly terrible. That's because our emotions can't comprehend suffering on such a massive scale. This is why we are riveted when one child falls down a well, but turn a blind eye to the millions of people who die every year for lack of clean water. And yet, the good news is that we are still wired to care about each other. We feel pleasure when someone else feels better. So give away some money. It'll make you feel good. And maybe give a little extra to that cause that doesn't make you feel anything at all.
Jonah Lehrer is the author of How We Decide. Post your comments on our Facebook page or at marketplace.org/money.
This is Tyler Huff in San Diego, California, and my 2011 savings goals are to increase my 401k and Roth IRA savings, to keep track of all my purchases, and to keep continuing to discern between my wants and my needs.
I'm Sheila McLaren, and I'm from Seattle, Washington. I've historically had a high rate of savings, but I don't approach it in a very structured way. So my financial resolution for 2011 is to really approach saving money with improved discipline. So instead of winging it in my head for 2011, I've made a detailed spreadsheet. I'm tracking what I save, tracking what I spend, and be much more conscientious about where the money's going.
I think it's safe to say that 2010 was a contradictory year when it comes to money and finance. On one side of the ledger, more people lost jobs, their homes went into foreclosure, their savings accounts did absolutely nothing for them. And all year we endured dire warnings about a double dip. On the other hand, the Dow hit a two-year high, passing the 11,000 mark, consumers got a new government office to help protect their finances, and looky here, the Great Recession is apparently over. What to make of all that? Well, for some insights, we have invited some voices familiar to our listeners. Ladies and gentlemen, week in and week out, they've given us sound advice and more than a few laughs. The Marketplace Money Bobsled Team. Kathy Kristoff of CBS Money Watch, David Lazarus from the Los Angeles Times, and Liz Pulliam-Weston with MSN. Welcome to you all.
Thank you very much.
I'm very sorry to say that Chris Farrell could not join us for this discussion, but I'm very glad to see you all and happy holidays.
Likewise.
Let's start with the Great Recession. It is apparently over, and I'd like to have Jon Stewart of The Daily Show tell us a little bit about this.
Earlier this week, Americans gathered around the trash can fires they have strategically placed outside of electronics store windows to watch a shocking piece of news.
Economists today announced they have studied the numbers, and the recession officially ended a year ago, July 2009.
Of course, no one is saying the country is prospering. But according to the National Bureau of Economic Research, an organization that examines the widely accepted objective measures recessions are judged by, such as industrial production, GDP growth, manufacturing.
Okay, everybody, right with him.
Right, exactly.
Okay, I have just one question out of this. David, I'll start with you. What?
Well, exactly. But what this shows is the divide between the statistical economy, which is out of recession, and the emotional economy, the real economy that people experience day in and day out. 15 million people unemployed, nearly 10% unemployment rate, very tough times. So you can say we are out of this recession technically, but at a gut level, we all know we're still stuck in a rut.
So Liz, what is the possible point of even deciding that we're out of it?
Well, it's all statistical and it has to do with the National Bureau of Economic Research and, you know, how they measure these things. And it really is kind of an academic thing at this point for most people because it's not going to affect their day-to-day lives. I mean, the Federal Reserve itself said it's going to be another 5 or 6 years before unemployment is really growing or back to normal, what we think of as normal. It's a tough call, and it doesn't sound like, you know, it makes any sense. But, you know, for the pointy-headed economists, I guess it does.
Like you, Kathy?
Exactly. Yeah. You know what? I mean, I think we should remember that they also told us that we were in a recession about a year after everybody knew we were in a recession. So the normal thing you say to the Bureau of Economic Research is, oh, no kidding, Sherlock. You know what I mean? But, you know, it was all the stuff that we were talking about in the past where the crash and burn was really, really, really bad, mm-hmm. really dramatic. But then you wiped out all sorts of debt through bankruptcy. You took out a whole bunch of homes through the foreclosure. And then those people were comparatively, believe it or not, better off because they didn't have that albatross around their necks. Hmm. This is going to ultimately improve things. And jobs, I mean, yes, unemployment is terrible, but 80% of the country is still working.
I'm often asked, why are retail sales up? Why is consumer confidence up amidst all of this? And I think the answer is we're just tired of being miserable.
Right.
It's been going on for so long now, and people have been scrimping and saving and also just feeling like the sky is about to fall any minute. Well, you can't live like that. And as Kathy says, a lot of people are still working, and I think people have come inured to the idea that, well, if I have a job, there's a good chance I'm going to keep that job, and I don't need to live like Chicken Little. And the fact that we're seeing so many people returning to the malls for the holiday season now really tells us that people are anxious to get out of this mess.
Well, but then let me ask you a question that I think I've addressed with each of you as the year has gone on, and in fact, over the last couple of years, which is this notion that we all learned enormous lessons out of the collapse of 2008, that we were going to, for the rest of our lives, change our habits. We were going to be better about saving, better about not spending too much. I have had my doubts all the way along.
Yes.
Have I been proven out yet?
Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to have any luck in teaching the baby boomers anything. I think they're going to bounce right back to what they're used to. I think there's more hope for the people in their 20s and 30s. Who had never experienced anything like this, for being a little more cautious and being a little bit more careful with credit. And also we had one heck of a reality check. You know, our incomes have been shrinking or stagnant for so long, and it was covered up by this incredible access to credit. When that went away, a lot of people realized that they weren't as well off as they thought they were. So I think that will curb some of the crazy spending. I don't think it will cure everybody.
But we said these same things right after the dot-coms imploded.
Exactly.
And that everyone would learn their lessons from that because they'd never experienced it before. What's interesting about this time around is look at consumer credit, for example. There's less of it. The savings rate is now up. I think one good thing that comes out of this is that people, consumers specifically, have learned how to manage their plastic. And what they've learned primarily is there are consequences.
Okay. I will say it once and I will say it only once. Yeah, told you. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about housing. This was, aside from jobs, I think probably the story of the year as well. Foreclosure, still an ugly scene. And this year, homeowners started to take things into their own hands. We've had this great walking away debate. Did we figure anything out in 2010?
This is so hard for me because, you know, raised a Lutheran. I've got this basic thing that you pay your bills. And then I see so many people that would be so much better off if they just gave up. You know, they're calling the banker time after time. Their paperwork's getting lost. They're deeply in the hole. And yet it's so hard to say, just let go. Because that is not at least part of my psyche. And I think for a lot of people, part of their psyche as well.
You know, what bothers me is that so many people bought homes with so little down and right. then used them as a piggy bank. I think if nothing else, maybe what this does is remind people that your home is the roof over your head. It's not an investment in a traditional sense. You're not caring as much about whether it appreciates as you are that you can actually stay there, you can afford the payments. You know, stop playing games with the roof over your head. It's an important asset.
One of the deterrents to filing for bankruptcy or walking away from your home was the stigma attached to that.
Yeah.
I think the stigma has faded. And that sort of upends the whole way we do things because that scarlet letter factor, I think that's now a thing of the past.
But that's very interesting. And I think you're right in many ways. But I have to say, every time we've addressed this issue on the show and had this debate about walking away, we get an avalanche of mail saying, look, I did everything right. Why should anybody get a break on this?
Right. Well, one of the problems is those people were also very resistant to helping foreclosure prevention. Mm-hmm. I heard a lot of those people saying, just let those, you know, stupid, greedy homeowners lose their houses, which helped the whole situation snowball and get worse. I think if we had early intervention and cram down so where bankruptcy judges could just reduce the amount of mortgage principal so people could afford their homes, we might have been able to avoid some of this fallout. Not all of it. It was going to happen. You know, it was kind of written on.
But then again, why shouldn't all of us get that then?
That's a great question. But I think at this point, once we realized what was going on, it was too late to figure out who was deserving and who was not. We were all going to get hit.
Yeah.
The fairness argument is compelling and it is correct, but at the same time, use a different analogy. If you are in a large ferry with a lot of other people who have all paid your ticket, and next to you is a little rowboat taking on water and that person's in danger of drowning, do you let him drown? No. You bring him aboard the ferry. And that's what this whole bailout, to use the term, is right. all about, is keeping the whole system solvent and keeping society intact.
But you can also see why people are so angry, because, you know, in a world without consequences, the only people who are stupid are the people who are responsible. And that is, I think, what so many people are looking at is like, OK, the bulk of the country actually is responsible. But that 10-20% that's not, the rest of are on our shoulders. And I think that is legitimately worrying a lot of people. And I think it's going to be the big issue of 2011.
Let me take David's analogy of the boat one step further and talk about what the government has done this year to provide a life raft for a lot of us in our finances. We had a Credit Card Reform Act. We had the Financial Reform Act. We have help with student loans, debt settlement companies. Now, without going into all the details of these, just how sweeping were these changes? And will they protect us from the next calamity?
They will not protect us. I mean, you know, we have food regulations and FDA, and we still sometimes have bad meat and bad, you know, produce. It happens. And the one thing that I worry about with all these protections is that people will not be as vigilant as they should be.
I've used this analogy before, but it was getting so frustrating for a while because the bullies used to pick on the subprime folks sort of off in the corner of the schoolyard, and everybody blew it off because it didn't affect them.
Mm-hmm.
And when the financial crisis and credit crunch happened and people with good credit scores and on-time payment histories started seeing their credit limits getting cut and their interest rates getting jacked up, then they saw what the rest of us saw. All the changes that have happened were necessary to kind of make the system a little more fair.
Well, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, we're sort of minimizing the sweep of some of the things we saw this year. And you ask any consumer advocate about, say, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, this is a really big deal. Up till now, all of this regulation was spread out over all these different agencies. It was a terrible system. That's how we got into this mess in the first place, because mom and dad were out in the living room while Junior was making a mess of the other room. And you don't want that. You want parental supervision at all times.
But is it parental supervision or is it a financial nanny state?
No, it's parental supervision. All this nanny state stuff, forget about it.
Okay.
I'm serious. I am serious. What we need is just a little good old-fashioned mom looking over your shoulder saying, what are you doing?
But doesn't it bother you that officially we have always had that? We've always had the ability of the Fed or the banking regulators, and they chose not to regulate. So this is what bothers me about the Consumer Financial Protection Agency is, yes, it will be really helpful for as long as you have somebody in there who decides to enforce the law. And it does not help you to pass more laws if they're not enforced.
One of the things that gives me hope, though, is that the consumer protection will be front and center with this bureau. I think the one of the real problems has been consumer protection has been a backwater at every agency that was trying to have some responsibility for it. It's like if you screwed up, you went to consumer protection and right. were never heard from again.
Right.
So maybe it's better that we have it under one umbrella with hopefully someone who can actually enforce the laws that are in place.
I ran down a list of major legislation, and the glaring omission there was health care, and I think it does deserve its separate, perhaps short discussion. Huge potential impact on consumers, particularly those who did not have any insurance previously, but was this the fix?
Well, I have to, declare my conflict of interest, which is I was one of those people that got the 39% increase in premium notice from Anthem, so
yeah.
I've been on the warpath for a while about this.
And that doesn't seem to be stopping.
No, they did have to back off of that, but they did increase
the rates. But for most
of
us, yeah, the rates have gone up.
Yeah.
And so people think, well, wait a minute, what happened?
Yeah. And if you are, the typical working family, you're paying so much more than you did 10 years or 20 years ago. And again, we're talking about incomes that are stagnant or dropping. So it's a bigger chunk of
yeah.
what you're taking home. I do see some good things in the law, but I don't know that that's going to solve the problem of ever escalating prices.
I've been writing in my column about the individual mandate, especially after that Virginia judge struck it down as unconstitutional.
Right.
The Obama administration is now appealing that.
And this is where the law said, basically, you have to have health insurance.
Nearly everybody has
yeah.
to, but it doesn't even get us all the way, because right now there's an estimated 50 million people who lack health insurance. The law would get us to about 30 million people covered. So, it's a Band-Aid over a gaping wound, and that's
yeah.
not a solution, but maybe it's better than what we had before. But I think the signature provision of the Health Care Reform Act was preventing insurers from turning away anybody with a so-called pre-existing condition. To do this is a major deal, but to accomplish it, you do have to bring as many people into the risk pool as possible. That means healthy people. Now, everyone is going to need health care at some point, so you're just playing the odds in different ways, but that's how it's going to work. The fact that so many people support the provision relating to insurers and pre-existing condition, but also oppose the mandate, and they do this by virtually equal numbers,
yeah,
two-thirds
right.
of Americans on,
right.
on all counts, that's a remarkable thing. It's a case of wanting a puppy but not wanting to clean up after it.
I can yeah. relate to that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, don't we
but
all
I clean
want
up
that.
After it.
Right. right. It's what we all want. And yet, if you have that, you have a disaster. Because really and truly, if they don't put in these mandates, if they don't put in strong mandates, you think health insurance premiums are going up now, they'll soar beyond anything you've ever imagined. And it's because you can't give people the ability to buy insurance after they find out they've got cancer,
right?
And so
it's like getting car insurance after you've had the accident.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Not gonna
right.
happen.
It's exactly right. And so there's no way that this law can work without mandates. And frankly, the mandates that are in the law are way, way, way too loose.
All right. Well, now is the point where I have to do the obligatory, since this is a year end and year beginning program. I'd like your predictions, please.
Oh my gosh.
For what we're going to see in 2011 in terms of personal finance.
I think that people are going to get progressively better off. I think that this is going to be an incredibly slow recovery, which is what I've been saying for 2 years. I think you're going to see 6 months from now people being a little bit more comfortable that the recession really is over. And I do think that we have learned some things from this recession.
Okay. Liz?
I always hate these because my college economics department did a contest, and all of us that had our degrees were supposed to guess what was going to happen with the economy, and I came in dead last. I mean, of all the graduates, I just blew it. So,
okay, David?
I will float one thing, which is I think credit will get a little bit more loose because, the lenders need to make some money. And we're already seeing that happening. So it will continue. So I'll make that my only prediction for the year.
Okay. Fair enough, David.
I look at the economic winds out there and I see them blowing in a really favorable direction at the moment. I just think we're coming out of the housing mess. I think the banking industry has cleaned up its act to a great extent. I see consumer sentiment very strong. Consumer confidence is up. I look at all of that and I get a sense that we've put a lot of the heavy lifting behind us. And so I think we're moving quickly in the right direction. And all of the forecasts that say that we weren't going to see any erosion in the unemployment rate until maybe Q3 or Q4 of 2011. I don't know. It could happen a little faster. And I think the reason for that is all eyes in Washington are on the 2012 elections, and they're going to do whatever they have to try and guarantee their party's strength, especially the president. And they'll spend what they have to, as we saw with this tax bill. And we're going to feel it.
All right. There you have it, folks. We will check in at the end of 2011 to see how much of this actually happened. I predict, and I think I can safely say, that our listeners will continue to have lots and lots of questions for the three of you and for our own Chris Farrell. So thank you for being on the show. We really appreciate it. You do a great service. Liz, Kathy, David, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year,
Tess.
My name is Bethany Zabel from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and my 2011 financial goal is to save more money. Just because I have money in my checking account doesn't mean I should spend it.
My name is Romney Patterson from Arnold, Maryland. My financial goal for 2011 is to quit smoking. In 2010, I spent $1,590.81 on cigarettes, and it's been a horrible waste of money.
My name is Erin Green. I'm from Chicago. I'm a recent college graduate, and I'm starting an entry-level salary, so I really want to start investing in the new year as one of my financial goals. I'm not sure what the difference is between the different types of investment vehicles. Should I have a Roth? Should I have a regular IRA? Should I have a 401k? It's something that I really want to get into, and I'm not really sure how to go about it.
I'm Sue Cush from White Sam in Washington. And my financial goals for 2011 are to consume locally and sustainably. And the most important task for me this year is to remove my retirement investments from Wall Street.
One of the biggest trends of 2010 was the rise of social media. Facebook and Twitter have already revolutionized the way we communicate with each other. Turns out they're also changing how we give to charities. Last year, social media accounted for more than $2 billion in donations. We heard earlier about our brains on giving, and now Marketplace's Jennifer Collins tells us social media are changing the way nonprofits operate.
Recognize this sound? The Salvation Army has been ringing bells like that for more than a century to get people to drop spare change into its little red kettles. But about 10 years ago, donations to those kettles started to fall. With the proliferation of credit and debit cards, people didn't always have change on hand. George Hood oversees development for the Salvation Army.
My cynical side about 5 years ago said there's going to be a day when these bell ringers and the red kettles are going to start to disappear.
So the Salvation Army began recruiting virtual bell ringers through Facebook and Twitter.
You get a virtual kettle that has your name on it, and then you email blast all of your friends and ask them to donate to the Salvation Army through your red kettle.
The effort generates nearly $3 million a year, and it's helped change the way the Salvation Army raises money. Hood says the group's traditional donor base is aging out. So the Salvation Army decided to phase out radio advertising and use that money to bolster its presence online.
We know that our future is dependent on connecting with emerging generations, and we know that we can't communicate with these emerging generations through newspapers and radios much longer. They're going to the internet to get all of their information.
Social media has also been essential to the success of small startup charities. Take Shelterbox USA. The group is part of a British charity that ships boxes with tents, water purifiers, and other basics to places hit by disasters. Veronica Brandon Miller had just started as executive director at the U.S. office in January when Haiti was hit by a massive earthquake.
There were two people in the office, me and the database manager.
Moments after the quake, they jumped online, sending out requests for help through Facebook and Twitter. Prominent bloggers soon picked up on their efforts.
And 43 minutes later, it was very interesting. CNN called my cell phone to see what we were doing. And I'm like, we are already on our way.
Shelterbox was eventually able to provide supplies for 250,000 Haitians. In the months after the earthquake, the group went from less than $1 million in donations to more than $10 million.
We had absolutely no money for getting our word out there. So social media really saved us.
And it just might help save that age-old practice of ringing bells for the Salvation Army. The group says since it started using social media, more donations are piling up in the real Red Kettles outside stores. That bell, by the way, is the Salvation Army's iPhone app. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace Money.
And now from new ways to donate to new ways to volunteer. I was surprised to learn that New York City has the second lowest volunteer rate for a major U.S. city, behind only Miami. Rachel Chung, a former investment banker, decided to do something about that. Her new startup is called Catchafire. The site connects skilled New York professionals with nonprofits needing their service. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
It's lovely to be here.
Now, you've described Catchafire as something like an eHarmony for professionals and nonprofits. Explain for us the problem that you saw and this site was created to address.
Sure. So the problem was something that I saw personally. And then when I started to research it, I saw that it was a much bigger problem. On the one hand, you have about 25 million professionals in the United States who have skills that can help build capacity within nonprofit organizations. On the other side of the equation, a statistic by Deloitte & Touche last year, 2009, says that 95% of nonprofits say that they need and want access to skilled volunteers, but they don't know where to go to find them. So Catchafire is actually providing these services to nonprofits at a cost that they can afford.
It really does sound like a matchmaking effort then.
It really is.
You mentioned that these volunteers are not given the opportunity to use their skills. Volunteering, that's all about offering your skills, not being given the opportunity to do something.
So I used to be an investment banker, and my bank offered me volunteer opportunities, you know, going out with the team and building a house or working at a soup kitchen. And that type of volunteer opportunity, I think, is very important. And I participate in those to this day. But I wanted to volunteer what I was building every day, which were my financial skills. And those opportunities were not available to me through my job. And they also weren't available to me when I looked for them outside of work.
Well, I know you're also joined in the studio today by one of the Catchafire volunteers, Robert Tsai. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
And your background is management consulting and investment banking. What made you decide to get involved in this?
Certainly, I was interested in applying the skills I had developed in my professional career towards making a positive change in this world. And so the good thing about the Catchafire platform was they did have a list or a menu of organizations that were looking for talent. And they also had very well-defined projects that they needed completed. And so I was matched with one nonprofit called Global Goods Partners on a market research project.
And describe that project.
Global Goods Partners actually is an e-commerce site. So they sell fair trade goods sourced from artisans around the world. So it's really operated as a nonprofit, but they are subject to market forces, right? So they have to compete against the Amazon.coms of the world. And so they definitely wanted help from professionals that knew about e-commerce that could help them, you know, analyze data and help them compete in the marketplace.
It's really exciting to hear Robert speak about his project as well, because nonprofits, you know, often have a hard time scoping projects and structuring them in a way that makes it easy for a busy professional. This project that he describes, a market research project, is very similar to the structure of our other projects, such as, you know, a logo design project or a social media campaign or a PR plan.
Yeah. Well, Robert, you know, I know you weren't in this for yourself. I mean, volunteering is all about giving of yourself. But can you give us a sense of what you think you've gained from this experience?
Well, certainly. If you think about where this economy is going these days and everyone's like scared of high unemployment, using these types of volunteer opportunities is a very good way to hone your skills, whether they are in PR or financial analysis. And if you're, you know, in the market to look for work, I think these types of experiences are just, you know, very positive ones to share as you're interviewing, to say, you know, hey, I do care about the world. I'm not just about the money and I'm not just about myself. And I think when we see what's been going on in the world today, I think we do need more of that.
All right. Rachel Chung, CEO and founder of Catchafire. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tess.
And Robert Tsai is a volunteer with the project. Thanks for being here as well.
Thanks, Tess.
And you can find more resources on volunteer networking sites and on social media fundraising at marketplace.org/money. We've spent some time talking about giving. How about a little time on taking? You know who's really good at that? Payday lenders. They give, sure, but they take an awful lot more. But for many, a payday loan is the only option. Last year, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation looked into ways banks could compete and offer safer, cheaper loans. Marketplace's Elisa Roth visited one lower-cost lender in Wilmington, Delaware.
Downtown Wilmington is full of shiny glass buildings that house dozens of banks and credit card companies. But drive west into the city's poorer neighborhoods, and there's an entirely different kind of financial institution.
We've got Easy Cash with the dollar sign in place of the S. We've got 123 Cash, again, the dollar sign in place of the S. So it's two adjacent shopping centers, Easy Money AMG. I guess up the street we missed Deals on Wheels. Your job is your credit.
On this stretch, every strip mall has one, if not two, payday lenders. Barbara Reed thinks desperate borrowers should have a new place to stop. She runs the financial management program at a nonprofit community organization called West End Neighborhood House. A couple of years ago, she started noticing that a lot of people who came to her for help owed money to payday lenders. So she started looking for alternatives.
We wanted the same-day cash. We wanted the quick, easy turnaround, but we wanted something that was affordable, something that was safe.
In other words, a payday loan, just cheaper. Payday lenders typically charge at least $20 for every $100 borrowed, and annual interest rates can go as high as 500%. At West End, there's no upfront fee. The interest rate is capped at 15%, and borrowers have 3 months to pay back the loan, rather than the 2 weeks they get at most payday lenders. To do it, West End partnered with Wilmington Trust, which is a big traditional bank. The community group does all the paperwork and approves the loans. The bank is the actual lender. Wilmington Trust is one of about 30 banks across the country that took part in a two-year FDIC pilot program for small, affordable loans.
Okay, they got to put in their first and last name, address.
Doreen Conti, one of the people who helps issue loans at West End, is showing the forms applicants have to fill out. Just like at a payday lender, all a borrower needs is an ID, a bank statement to make sure they're not overdrawn, a pay stub, and a utility bill. But if payday lenders are strictly business, fast cash, no questions asked, West End wants to get personal. Applicants have to sit down with a counselor and go over their family budget. Here's Barbara Reed, the director of the program, again.
We want to look at your income. We want to look at your expenses. We want to help you see why you're in this financial crisis. What are some things you could do differently to prevent this financial crisis?
They sit down and they show it to you in black and white.
Marilyn Roman borrowed $500 from West End earlier this year. She says the budget counseling has helped her manage her money better.
Then you see where your money is going. And that's what a lot of us don't do. If we don't see it in black and white, it doesn't make sense.
Like a lot of clients, Roman had used a payday lender before she came to West End. One time, it cost her $600 to pay back a $400 loan. So far, West End has loaned out $300,000 to people like Roman. The default rate is less than 8%, which is high compared to regular banks, but which the FDIC says is roughly in line with default rates for unsecured personal loans and credit cards. Rayanne Miller works for the FDIC. She's convinced mainstream banks like Wilmington Trust can afford to offer alternatives to high-cost payday loans. They probably won't be terribly profitable, but banks can use them to build new relationships in the communities they serve.
We've been conducting meetings around the country to try and promote the product. So hopefully more institutions will see that it can be done in a reasonable manner and a profitable manner.
West End and Wilmington Trust are already replicating their program. Two other agencies now offer the loans, and West End is negotiating with two more. In Wilmington, Delaware, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace Money.
And finally, this New Year's weekend, many of you will no doubt resolve to be more green in 2011. Do your part and more to help the planet. So maybe you'll be one of those people. Perhaps you can tell I'm not.
who reuses towels and skips the daily housekeeping at hotels. Okay, 50 lashes for me, I know. But if you're looking for an excuse not to go green in your room, here's one. Cutting back on water and electricity might also be cutting back on something else, jobs. Sean Cole reports.
As I methodically walked the floors of Starwood's Sheraton Center, Toronto, I kept seeing these cards hanging from the doorknobs. I counted them, quietly.
Here's one Make a Green Choice card.
They're like Do Not Disturb cards, but they say, in big letters, Make a Green Choice.
12. 13. 14. This is a hot floor.
The card means don't clean my room. Housekeepers can't go in. In exchange, the guest gets a $5 coupon toward food or beverages within the hotel. Because less cleaning saves water and electricity. Fewer chemicals go down the drain. Or that's the hotel's side. The room attendants have another name for the Make a Green Choice program. They call it the Fake Green Choice Program.
Yeah, it's fake.
Brigida Ruiz is a shop steward for a union called Unite Here. She's been a room attendant at the Sheraton Center Toronto for 19 years. And she says when you hang that card on your door, you're not just cutting back on water and electricity.
You also cut the hours from the room attendant. If 200 guests hang that tonight, somebody count how many room attendants they have to cut.
Of course, there are only 29 cards out of more than 1,300 rooms the night I went. The point is, less cleaning means fewer cleaners. Ruiz says this is just a sneaky way of reducing payroll. Also, guests already had the option of reusing their sheets and towels. So the only difference Make a Green Choice makes, she says, is a messy one.
And they're using it for 3 days to 5 days to 7 days. And when they check out, the room is very bad. It's really filthy, dirty, dusty.
And it takes her 3 times longer to clean it, she says, which requires even more water and cleaning fluid than usual. I called the general manager of the Sheraton, who referred me to parent company Starwood, who never provided someone to interview despite several requests. The company did email a statement saying Make a Green Choice has saved nearly 30 million gallons of water, about 129,000 kilowatts of electricity, and 37,000 gallons of chemicals thus far. This is at more than 160 Sheraton and Westin hotels across North America. Unite Here is doubtful about those stats and has made this a bargaining issue in ongoing contract negotiations. They want to kill the program, just like they were able to do at 5 hotels in Hawaii.
On Kauai, where they have most actively promoted the program, we've seen as much as a 25% loss of work hours in our housekeeping department.
Eric Gill is with Unite Here Local 5 in Honolulu. He says a partner company to Starwood wanted to convert a bunch of hotel rooms into private condos, which again would mean fewer hotel rooms to clean. Negotiations began.
We absolutely needed hotel accommodations to drive our jobs. And so the discussion became how many of this and how many of that. And when we came down to the numbers, the number of hotel rooms they were offering would work if there's no green program.
So the company conceded. Room attendants in Toronto have no such leverage. But the thing I keep coming back to is this.
We believe that most people who assertively care about preserving the environment are the kind of people who would also care about the jobs and livelihoods of the workers in the rooms that they stay in.
Exactly. So the hotel says, help us conserve, and the union says, help us keep our hours, and blah! It's enough to drive socially conscious vacationers insane. All I can tell you is what I'm going to do the next time I go to a Sheraton. Not take the stairs.
I wonder how many floors this hotel has.
43. There are 43 floors. In Toronto, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
My name is Kateri Osborne. I'm from Silver Spring, Maryland. My 2011 financial goals are to establish an emergency fund, 50% funded by the end of the year.
This is Michael Wilcox. I'm calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. And my 2011 resolution is to limit my spending on dining out to $75 when I'm with my friends and $20 per month when I'm alone. In 2010, I tried to limit myself to $50 per month flat, but I totally failed. Next year, I'm going to let myself enjoy myself with my friends, but not go overboard.
This is Teresa Mannix from Las Vegas, Nevada, and my 2011 resolutions revolving around money have to do with getting out from under a very crippling underwater mortgage, getting my daughter to get out and live on her own once she graduates in June,
learn to live on less.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, Chicken Little tends to squawk every time a new technology comes along to change our lives.
March 22nd, 1876 on the New York Times, it describes what this technology is, but then the writer says it's going to empty concert halls and churches and people will never leave their home again.
That new technology, it was the telephone. We'll explore life in the future with an author who says he's living it. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme is composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. Happy 2011, everyone. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term investment strategies built on experience, discipline, and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. This is Putnam Today.
American Public Media.